The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. From the North Carolina Reading Service, the new issue of Indie Week is read by John Federson. Our current issue, dated September 16th, 2020. And I'm sure you're all agog to learn who our musicians are today performing the theme song. And I can't tell you, it is a mystery. It's a mystery duo, and they call themselves Phil and Bill. And they perform inside cardboard boxes, so their identities will remain unrevealed. So we'll hear from them at the end of the show. And now I'd better get on with the show, speaking of that. And we'll begin with a note from the Lee Toss, Raleigh News Editor. We have received many messages asking if our endorsements for the election will be published early this year. In a perfect world, they would have dropped as your absentee ballot arrived in your mailbox. Unfortunately, we're short-staffed at an unprecedented time because of the amount of work behind our endorsements, our carefully tailored questionnaires, background research, soliciting community input, we're unable to responsibly move up the timeline. So they will be published as a special issue on October 14th. If you want to wait on us while ensuring your vote gets counted, remember, you don't have to rely on snail mail. You can drop off your completed ballot in person at your local Board of Elections office. And we'll skip op-ed for the moment. If we have time for that, we'll get on with it. But Charlie Zong begins our news columns from Durham called Is 8 Enough? A summer of change was just beginning when Durham's elected leaders vowed on June 15th to transform policing in response to local and national protests against systemic racism and police brutality, matters long debated in Durham. Among other promises, Mayor Steve Shule and council members pledged to review and reform the police department's rules on police use of force in the next 90 days. With that deadline approaching, the mayor and Police Chief Sherilyn Davis are preparing a presentation concerning the department's rules on police use of force, said David Anthony, the executive officer to the police chief. The mayor's office and police department have not specified a release date or whether the presentation will be the city's final response to the 90-day pledge. Force, in this context, means physical tactics police can use against people who don't comply with lawful orders, as spelled out in department policies. The department updated those policies in June, but activists and some city council members say some rules are still not clear enough. The reform campaign, 8 Can't Wait, a project by Campaign Zero, a national group that promotes what they say are evidence-based reforms, won the support of some Durham officials, activists, and residents. Launched June 3rd, the campaign urges police departments across the nation to adopt 8 policies intended to restrict the use of force. They include banning chokeholds, requiring officers to exhaust all means before using deadly options like firearms, and requiring police to intervene if they witness another officer using excessive force. Durham Police Department spokesperson Amanda Fitzpatrick said in an email that the department's rules are currently aligned with the recommendations. But an analysis by the 9th Street Journal of Durham's Manual of Rules for Officers, which was updated on June 10th, found that DPD written policies meet only 6 of the 8 recommendations explicitly. Efforts to reform how police interact with residents began long before this summer. In 2013, a 17-year-old named Jesus Huerta committed suicide in the back of a Durham police cruiser. Investigators determined Huerta shot himself with a gun hidden on him at the time of his arrest, and Officer Samuel Duncan was suspended without pay for violating search protocols and failing to switch on the cruiser's video and audio recording devices. Though the Huerta family ultimately accepted the findings, police donned riot gear and released tear gas at a vigil for Huerta. The controversy intensified pressure on the city to reform its police department. from 2013 to 2019, 203 people were killed by police in North Carolina, according to the Mapping Police Violence Research Project. Black people were 38% of those killed, though they make up only 21% of the state's population. Durham, where people killed five black people and one white person between 2013 and 19, had the largest racial disparity between rates of black and white civilians killed by police among major cities in the state, the research project found. Officers were not charged in any of the cases, as tracked by Mapping Police Violence. In 2015, the city commissioned a study by the International Association of Chiefs of Police that found that the Durham Police Department faced, quote, deteriorating relationships with the community and a, quote, lack of public trust, stemming partly from perceptions of racism and discriminatory practices. In 2016, the city hired Police Chief Sarah Lynn Davis, who vowed to build a culture of trust between police and the community. Durham has made significant strides since Huerta's death in 2013, said City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton. They include requiring police to obtain written consent before vehicle searches, de-emphasizing marijuana violations, and mounting monitoring data on traffic stops for racial disparities. Davis has been a change agent who led a definite shift in the culture of our police department, Middleton said. But recent controversy over a police officer being accused of assaulting a high school student and officers drawing weapons on three youngsters have renewed demands for an end to police violence. The eight Can't Wait recommendations are based on Campaign Zero's 2016 analysis of civilian deaths involving officers and restrictions on the use of force at 91 of the 100 largest police departments in the country, including Durham. The group's analysis says the typical department uses only three of the eight deadly force reduction practices intended to help prevent officers from harming or killing civilians. According to the group, in 2015, Durham had only two of eight policies on the books explicitly. Samuel Sinyangwe, a co-founder of 8 Can't Wait, said harm reduction is important, and you can't enforce what isn't against the rules. Cities across the country, including Raleigh and Durham, have moved to reform their policies in line with 8 Can't Wait recommendations. With revisions made in June, the Durham Police Department's General Orders Manual explicitly lists six of the eight recommendations. What's missing? Durham officers are encouraged, but not required, to exhaust all possible alternatives before resorting to deadly force, the manual states. Officers are required to file a use of force report only if physical force or injury occurs. The 8 Can't Wait recommendations say reports should be filed every time violence is threatened, including when officers point guns at people. Fitzpatrick told the Ninth Street Journal that the manual is being updated, quote, to explicitly state officers have a duty to intervene to prevent or stop excessive force if witnessed. The manual states officers are not trained in the use of chokeholds, nor are they listed among authorized force options, which escalate from hand techniques and pepper spray up to firearms. But the manual doesn't say explicitly that chokeholds are prohibited either. In an interview, Mayor Pro Tem Gillian Johnson said that ambiguity in the policy is a problem. Johnson, early this year, criticized Durham as one of the poorest performing cities when it comes to having a clear and explicit use of force policy, citing the absence of an explicit ban on chokeholds and a department permitting officers to use deadly force before exhausting other options if the officer deems it objectively reasonable, according to the manual. Johnson said, when you give the officer discretion to determine whether it's reasonable, that's my main point of contention with the interpretation that we meet these guidelines. Those hedges make it so we don't actually meet the guidelines as they're written. She and a co-author called for significant improvements in a January op-ed in USA Today that recently retired city manager Tom Bonfield and council member Mark Anthony Middleton strongly rebuked. Middleton said he did not agree that police use of force rules were only effective if they closely followed the wording in standards created by 8 Can't Wait or other groups. It's not true, he said, that our department is woefully lacking in use of force standards. While 8 Kentwaite has gained traction among local governments, being pressured to take action, not all local activists agree that its agenda is enough. Some say critics, Durham included, should defund or abolish their police departments and focus instead on community wellness and crime prevention. Andrea Hudson, director of the North Carolina Community Bail Fund, said she considers the emphasis on 8 Kentwaite a distraction from defunding the police and spending more money on community health and safety initiatives. She said, a system that has white supremacy embedded in it will not change just because you banned them from doing things they shouldn't have been using in the first place. But city council members remain focused on achieving what they say is sustainable, long-term change. The council in June unanimously passed the city's $502 million 2020-21 budget, which included $70 million for the police, despite a vocal campaign from local activists. In the June op-ed in Spectacular magazine, Middleton pointed to the city council's 2019 decision to reject hiring 18 officers, only to hire 6 officers several months later in response to gang violence, as evidence that the city needs to first develop viable alternatives to the police. Also in June, council members committed $1 million to form a community safety and wellness task force, a resident-led group that will recommend alternatives to traditional policing. As the city wraps up its 90-day pledge to review police use of force rules, Johnson said she wants to see an explicit ban on chokeholds and more comprehensive reporting when police use force. But Johnson's end goal is deeper. These reforms are useful, but they're not systemic reforms, she says. Ultimately, I want to do less policing overall. Now from Raleigh, Rat Rage, from Chapel Hill, Rat Rage by Leah Taus. In March, UNC Chapel Hill instructed its laboratories to suspend all experiments deemed non-essential as the school prepared to shut down on-campus activities due to the rapidly spreading coronavirus. Scientists were instructed to write priority in red ink on the rodent cages that needed to be maintained. The rest of the animals were likely euthanized, a new complaint from animal rights organization PETA claims. And while that's terrible, it's not exactly what PETA is protesting. They want to know why taxpayer money was used to fund non-essential experiments in the first place, if they weren't necessary, and are calling on State Auditor Beth Wood to find out what happened after the school shut down. Vice President of PETA Shailen Gala said in a statement, UNC Chapel Hill's experiments on animal were undoubtedly cruel, and apparently not even the school can justify them. PETA is calling on state officials to follow the money and prevent taxpayer waste and animal suffering in laboratories that should never have received funding in the first place. This isn't PETA's first clash with UNC. The organization previously conducted undercover investigations of the school's rodent laboratories in 2002 and 2003, claiming to discover understaffing, neglect, overcrowding, and animal cruelty. In 2015, following more undercover investigations at factory farms, North Carolina passed a law to keep animal rights organizations from going undercover by giving employers the ability to sue those who leak internal documents. However, a court overruled the so-called ag-gag law earlier this year due to First Amendment concerns. Not only would it stop legitimate whistleblowers and allow employers to conceal criminal activity, but it would also prevent journalists from doing their jobs. But as one smokescreen lifted, the pandemic seemingly dropped another. As coronavirus panic spread over the country in March, the school, which receives $543 million in state funding annually, some of which is funneled into its agricultural experiments, scaled down its laboratories. All experiments that fell outside critical research activity were to be ramped down, curtailed, suspended, or delayed by March 25th. Exactly what that entailed was left ambiguous. But PETA believes the result was, quote, the destruction of hundreds of animals UNC Chapel Hill deemed extraneous, non-critical, or non-essential, or described using similar terminology. The school did not respond to the Indy's inquiry about how many non-essential animals were euthanized that did not fall under critical research activity. Instead, they put out a PR statement highlighting the importance of the research conducted at the school. And that said the school's media team. Critical research activity, including the care and maintenance of our animal population, is continuing under the university's reduced operations. UNC Chapel Hill is committed to humanely caring for the animals our researchers rely on in their search to cure and treat disease, both during normal operations and in this time of reduced operations. Our employees and the administration take their ethical responsibility to care for our animals very seriously. No one is debating the necessity of critical research, but if the school has nothing to hide, then why not be transparent about what happened at the labs this spring? Furthermore, it's unclear how much of the research happening at the school falls outside of the realm of critical. On both counts, UNC isn't telling. PETA believes that ceasing these experiments will cost more in the long run because the cost of restarting the research and repopulating the animals. This non-essential research, PETA claims, comes at, quote, at an apparent annual cost of millions of dollars, some of which may have been funded by the state, and is the height of absurdity and wastefulness. That deserves a hard look, not only from an ethical, but also a financial perspective. The mysterious extent of that wastefulness might interest Wood, a Democrat running for re-election this year, who has served as an auditor for a decade. She did not respond to the Indy's inquiry about whether she intends to investigate the school's animal testing programs or the aftermath of shutting down its labs. And now, also from Chapel Hill and Mary King, if need be, a student-run aid fund that supports financially struggling LGBTQ students of color at UNC Chapel Hill aimed to raise $500 within the first week of September, but the fund reached its goal nearly overnight. Eri Kakoki, a junior and the co-president of UNC Queer and Trans People of Color, said the fund went live the night before September 1. By the afternoon of September 2, donations had met the $500 threshold. Most people have discovered the fund through the small digital flyers the organization posted on its social media pages, she said. UNC QTPOC has also asked other campus LGBTQ organizations to promote the fund to their own members. She says it really came down to people cared about the community and they wanted to make sure that queer students were safe and in good health. UNC's School of Education Graduate Student Association donated $300 from funds it had previously raised, said doctoral student John Hernandez Atkins, the association's president at the time. The other $200 consisted of individual contributions, Kakoki said. The group uses its Venmo handle at QTPOC-UNC. At QTPOC-UNC to collect and distribute donations. Although white queer students can apply to the fund, Kakoki said LGBTQ students of color are prioritized. To request aid, students can fill out a form on UNC QTPOC's website. We would distribute however much they needed, Kakoki said, whether it was for a meal or for gas or for things like housing, for instance, which was major because a lot of people had to move out of their dorms early this semester because of the pandemic outbreak. That really left students in a kind of disarray, and a lot of people needed help with the transition. To verify the applicants are UNC students, the form requires them to submit their names, class levels, university-granted personal ID numbers, and then they must specify a dollar amount to request. From there, they are encouraged to provide only as much detail as they feel comfortable about why they are requesting these funds. Kakuki said, "We really felt that what was important to this community is trust, and we didn't want to force people to explain themselves. That's not what we plan to do to our community. There's no way to prove if you're LGBT plus, and we certainly don't feel like pushing them to send a picture of themselves or anything. So I guess part of it is based on trust, but we're really relying on that personal ID as a verification." Andrea Pino Silva, a UNC alum and digital organizer who advised the group in setting up the fund, said that while larger charities and community organizations are essential for achieving longer-term goals, mutual aid funds help fulfill immediate needs. Mutual aid funds also incur fewer overhead costs, so more of the donated money goes straight to the communities in need. Pina Silva said, "The power is really much more in the investment of the community itself, who's leading the fight, and should be getting the funding directly." So far, the fund has received 8 requests. Kakuki said some requests have involved housing expenses, while others have related to LGBTQ-specific medical and hormone treatments. For now, requests are capped at $100, but UNC QTPOC hopes to raise that maximum, Kakuki said. As a semester of virtual undergraduate classes continues, the organization plans to keep spreading awareness of the fund via social media and word of mouth. After surpassing their $500 goal, they're still deciding which number to aim for next. And Kakuki says, "Just because this is moving a lot faster than we first expected, you know, it's really on the rise here. But we're definitely planning on upping our goal so that we have a greater capacity to help the community on campus." And from Tomasi McDonald in Durham, broken chain. Does the doctrine of sovereign immunity in North Carolina give members of law enforcement a license for misconduct? A Durham County case was dismissed by a Superior Court judge in January because qualified immunity bars legal actions against governmental entities, including law officers, absent a consent or waiver. Donald Dean is an Army combat veteran who says he was targeted by Durham Sheriff's deputies in 2016 and falsely accused of being a drug kingpin. Dean, who turned 40 last month, struggled for more than 2 years after sheriff's deputies in unmarked cars pulled him out of his 2013 Dodge Charger and manhandled him so badly they aggravated injuries he had received in Iraq and Afghanistan. After the trauma of the beating, false accusations, and wrongful imprisonment, Dean lost everything. He lost 3 security jobs that paid more than $35 an hour after the sheriff's office did not return his handguns. His car was repossessed after he fell behind on payments. He fell behind on child support and had to go to jail. The fiancé he was planning to build a home with ended their relationship. He slept in his car with his belongings before he ended up on his mama's couch. "I felt like killing myself," he told the Indy. On April 18, 2019, 3 years after deputies snatched Dean out of his car and accused him of selling drugs, attorneys Gwendolyn Haley of Mebane and Florence Bowens of Durham filed a complaint seeking compensation and punitive damages of at least $250,000 on his behalf. The attorneys accused nearly a dozen deputies and supervising detective Casey Norwood of depriving Dean of his civil rights with an unlawful search of his car, seizure of handguns, false imprisonment, fraud, and the intentional infliction of emotional distress. But Dean's day in court was short-lived. On January 13, 2020, Durham Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson dismissed the case. Haley said the judge was restricted by the sheriff's office attorney's claims of sovereign immunity, which shields law enforcement agencies from a lawsuit of any kind unless the state consents to be sued. "That's all you heard was sovereign immunity, says Haley, who also worries that the deputy's body and dash cam footage of the confrontation with Dean may be destroyed. The NAACP took an interest in the case in the summer of 2017, says Vivian Timlick, executive director of the Durham chapter. She remembers the sheriff's attorney refrain, "It's not true. It couldn't have happened. The sheriff's office has integrity." "Our heads just dropped," Timlick says. "Mr. Dean was injured. We have medical records, and his car was torn apart." Dean was unable to afford an attorney, and Timlick says it was difficult to find one in Durham to take the case. Haley and Bowens picked up the case contingent upon Dean receiving compensation. These days, Dean is finally doing better, though he lost in his bid to hold the deputies accountable, being awarded full disability and a retroactive lump sum in June of last year has provided some solace. He has a one-bedroom apartment in southwest Durham. He's converted the den into a bedroom for his 19-year-old daughter, who's taking virtual classes at Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte. There's pastel art on a recessed wall in the dining area. The splash of color accentuates the light gray sectional sofa and comfortable recliner in the living room. Track lighting in the kitchen gives the place a cool and calm ambience. Dean, a stocky, bald-pated guy wearing a red polo t-shirt, blue cargo shorts, and flip-flops, says, "Everything in here is fresh. I came here with nothing." According to the complaint, the sheriff's deputies stopped Dean's Dodge Charger on North Carolina 98 in East Durham, pulled him out of the car with guns drawn, slammed him to the asphalt face down, and handcuffed him. One of the officers who wore the hooded mask that's part of the vice squad tactical gear pinned Dean on the ground with a knee on his neck, while a second deputy had a boot on his spine. Norwood arrived and told the deputies, "Good job, and we got him now." Norwood twice called Dean a dumb MF and said, "In order to get out of this, you're going to have to give me something, MF," according to the complaint. When the deputies transported Dean to the interrogation room at the sheriff's office on Dillard Street, they handcuffed him to a table, like a dog, and continued to question him about being a drug dealer. According to the complaint, one of the deputies pointed to a gold chain Dean was wearing and said, "I've been doing this for over 20 years, and you sure look like a drug dealer to me." Dean was born in Oakland, California. He moved to Durham with his mother when he was 7. Early on, he made a decision that determined his life's trajectory. "I wanted to do things the right way," Dean says, "to break generational curses of poverty and a fatherless household. I was raised by a single mom, and my dad was part of the 1980s crack epidemic. He did time in prison. I had to learn how to become a man on my own and find a way to support my family." He attended Durham Public Schools and graduated from Tar Heel Challenge Academy, a military school in Salemburg. In 2000, he enlisted in the Navy. Following a 4-year stint, he joined the U.S. Army Reserves through the Blue to Green program, before going on active duty in 2005. He looked forward to a 20-year career in the military and planned to serve in all 4 branches, but then he was wounded in Iraq. He says, "I was in a convoy and the vehicle 40 feet in front of me hit an IED. The explosion ricocheted, which caused our vehicle to flip. Part of the metal from the Humvee's frame went into his kneecap. The hot metal was rubbery, and Dean's fellow soldiers were able to pull the shrapnel out. If not, I would have lost my lower leg," he says. Dean's military career ended on August 12, 2008, with an honorable discharge for medical reasons. He enrolled at the Aviation Institute of Maintenance in Virginia and then in an HVAC program at Everest College. During that time, he was offered work as a mechanic for Mantech International, a military contractor in Afghanistan. He worked in the war zone to help repair combat vehicles. It was Ramadan in the summer of 2013 when a missile landed at the base where Dean worked. "I fell off the vehicle I was working on and split the side of my head open. That's all I can remember, he says. "I woke up with 9 staples in my head." Dean came home to a woman he had met while working in Afghanistan. They clicked as a couple and moved into a home together near Hillside High School in Durham. Dean landed 3 jobs as an armed security guard. Then came the encounter with the sheriff's deputies that led to what he calls his downfall. On August 7, 2016, Dean had an appointment at the VA hospital where he received injections every 6 months for headaches and nerve damage. Dean says he had to find someone to ride with him because medical officials would not allow him to drive after taking the heavy dosages of pain medicine. The only person available was Jason Brown. Dean says that when he went to pick Brown up, he didn't know his friend was wanted by police for failing to appear in court. Dean and Brown stopped for a red light at the intersection of NC 98 and Lynn Road. Dean says he traveled slowly through the light after a change and noticed a sheriff's patrol car pull behind him. The cruiser lights were flashing, but the siren was not activated. According to the complaint, Dean stepped on his brakes and turned on his signal to indicate he was moving into the far right lane out of the patrol car's way. That's when a white Crown Victoria sped up and struck Dean's Dodge Charger to bring it to a halt. Nearly half a dozen deputies rushed to the Dodge with guns drawn. One of the deputies pulled Dean out of the car, slammed him on the ground, and handcuffed him. Dean says, "I instantly knew what was going on. They're thinking my friend is a felon. They're about to shoot us because they think he's going to run." Dean knew Brown had previous drug-related run-ins with law officers. According to a motion filed in November, deputies targeted Brown after he sold marijuana and cocaine to a confidential informant. Dean thinks the deputies looked at his car and the gold chain around his neck and fingered him as Brown's supplier. The tension eased a bit after the deputy searched his car, found his military ID and the contractor ID from Afghanistan. They also found the 2 handguns Dean used for security and his concealed carry permit. One element of the traffic stop was particularly painful for Dean. Once the white deputies realized he wasn't a drug dealer, they backed off and told him they were just doing their job. Dean says supervising Detective Casey Norwood, who is black, acted as if he had hit the jackpot. "He told me I was the dumbest vet he knew to hang out with the dumbest drug dealer in town." While being questioned at the sheriff's office, one of the deputies told Dean they had an arrest warrant for him if he didn't say the guns found in his car belonged to Brown, according to the complaint. Norwood told Dean, "You're not going no MF where you tell unless tell you tell me what I want to know." Counting on Dean to lay a false charge on Brown, Norwood slid a piece of paper and pen to Dean, according to the complaint. Dean told him he couldn't say weapons belonged to Brown and explained that he purchased the firearms, for which were registered in his name for his work as a security guard. Norwood and the detective left the room and never came back. Other officers uncuffed Dean from the table, handed him back his license, and told him he was free to go. Dean was unable to retrieve his firearms from the sheriff's office for nearly a year. When Dean left the sheriff's office that day, he went to the hospital for treatment of his injuries. The military vet's encounter with the deputies happened more than 4 years ago. But for Dean, who always wanted to do things the right way, the pain endures. Well, now we'll move on to some arts, culture, and in this case, music. Will Atkinson, a music columnist here at IndieWeek, writes Lamb in Wolf's Clothing. A couple of weeks before the release of Bile and Bone, their new album with Lauren Francis, Al Riggs's right arm is wrapped in a cast. Recently, doctors had removed a ganglion cyst the size of a Brussels sprout from Riggs's wrist, a lump that, while mostly painless, had been bothering them at least since they named an album Ganglion in January. Riggs recounts this episode with the same wry, detached bemusement that features so prominently in their music. They recall the bizarre experience of going under general anesthesia only to wake up what felt like seconds later, the surgery completed. Now they have to keep sunscreen on the wound for a year, which is just the kind of idiosyncratic detail that might appear in an Al Riggs song. "Every time I go out, I have to put on like SPF 30, Riggs says with a laugh. I've never heard of having to do that, but I've never had this intensive of a surgery. An intensive surgery might just be the only thing that could slow down the prolific output of Riggs, who writes and releases music at an astonishing clip. Since they started performing solo in 2012, they put out dozens of full-length albums with numerous one-off singles and covers in between, all while finding time to join the Mountain Goats on their Goths tour in 2018. Now, they're deep in the publicity cycle for Bile and Bone, which comes out September 18 on Riggs' Horse Complex label. Yet even in the weeks before the surgery, Riggs was rushing to finish another project from their home studio in Durham. This is to say that a new Al Riggs record is hardly a rarity, even if they're consistently excellent. But Bile and Bone is different than their usual projects. For one, it's the most purely collaborative effort Riggs has released to date, with Frances sharing equal billing for her contributions as producer. Riggs says, "I'm not lying when I say that if anything on this album sounds different or good, it's because of Lauren and her influence. Everyone I bring in to work with ends up changing the song." It's also the longest time Riggs has spent developing a release. When it comes to producing music, they're an embodiment of the DIY ethic. They're a staunch defender of Apple's Garage Band software, which they've used for years. Riggs says, "If it ain't broke, don't fix it." And they typically mix tracks on their own. But Bile and Bone germinated over a span of years with some of its tracks, featuring ideas from as far back as 2016. To mix and master the recordings, Riggs and Frances enlisted Ali Rogers, a local musician whose engineering experience includes working on the crew of erstwhile Raleigh resident Bon Iver's acclaimed I. The result is an album that is at once intimate and expansive, while staying true to Riggs's identity as a songwriter. Their plain-spoken lyrics and thorny acoustic guitar work remain central, but they're elevated by Frances's arrangement, which plays nearly orchestral flourishes over insistent yet understated rhythm tracks. Frances said, "Let's make something big and pretty for a change," explaining her way of thinking about the project. The first track, Werewolf, was the first song Riggs shared with Frances when the collaboration began. The song unfolds like a spring morning, opening with a memorable image. "If you're sitting straight up in the middle of the city, you can pass through 8 different weather patterns in a day," Riggs sings as an electric piano sparkles to life. "Love is an Old Bullet" follows, featuring backing vocals from Vaughn Aid's Rook Grubbs, who also sings on the title track. Apex Twin is a highly personal meditation on childhood and multiverse theory that's named after the famous British electronic musician Apex Twin, though you'd be forgiven if you don't hear a resemblance. Dying Bedmaker Variation includes an interpolation of an arrangement by the legendary American primitive guitarist John Fahey, while the last 2 minutes of album closer Past Few Shows dissolve into soothing ambience. But of course, it wouldn't be an Al Riggs album if there weren't some mischief to pull one over on the audience, as Riggs puts it. Riggs says, "I want to make a very knowingly beautiful and well-made album, and everything about it, I want it to turn people off. How can I make a really beautiful thing surrounded by all this disgusting imagery?" Though these are some of the prettiest songs Riggs has written, they arrive under a title evoking guts and gore. The cover art, which was designed by illustrator and graphic novelist Cameron Lucente, features the ripped, shirtless chest of a werewolf, which Riggs maintained has nothing to do with the music beyond the title of the first track. Viscera and comic book monsters aside, Bile and Bones is remarkably inviting, thanks in large part to Francis's dexterous guitar and production. Riggs and Francis seem to have as harmonious a producer-songwriter relationship as one could hope for. They rarely disagreed over arrangements. Picture it better is what I kept saying to myself while recording the album. Riggs says, this isn't a fight. It isn't a battle for dominance. It's a collaboration. And as someone who hasn't really collaborated at this level before, that was a hard thing to come to terms with early on. But once I did, everything flowed naturally. Francis adds, I'm very low and high maintenance at the same time, I think. You have to know what hill to die on. You have to pick and choose your battles. Frances is modest about her contributions. I never thought my name would be on the record, she admits, but it's clear she was instrumental in crafting the record's atmosphere. After hearing some of her earliest arrangements, it became evident to Riggs that Bile and Bone was no longer my record, but ours. The collaboration goes back to when Frances lived in Chapel Hill, performing with her former band, Fluorescence. Impressed by her playing, Riggs wanted to get to know her. It wasn't long before Frances joined Riggs' backing band on a Mountain Goats tour. Riggs says of the first time they practiced with Frances, I was immediately blown away. She's adding all these ideas to the song that I didn't even think of. By the time work on Bile and Bone began, Frances had moved to New York. Riggs would send her demos of the song, and Frances would record ideas for accompaniments. Some of the original iPhone recordings that Riggs sent, in fact, wound up on the final mixes, including Dying Bedmaker Variation and Livalon. But for the most part, they sought to avoid remote recording as much as possible, and Riggs made the trip to New York twice to work on the album. Frances said of the cramped Chelsea apartment where the initial sessions took place, I basically had an IKEA desk with two monitors on it and an Apollo twin interface. We made a pop filter using a pair of hosiery and a hanger. Work on that album continued between Durham and New York over the months that followed. A last-minute addition to the Hopscotch lineup in 2019 allowed Riggs and Frances to play songs from the album live for the first time in an enviable slot at Raleigh's Fletcher Hall, ahead of Daughter of Swords, Gruff Rice, and Kate Le Bon. The final stretch of production was bookended by two events involving the late John Prine, whom Riggs considers a hero and a major influence. In November 2019, Riggs had the chance to see Prine perform at DPAC, just as the recording for Bile and Bone concluded. In April, Prine died of COVID-19. At the time, Bile and Bone was in the final stages of mixing, and Riggs and Frances chose to dedicate this album to Prine. There's a kindness and an empathy and a sweetness to all how he writes, and a simplicity to it all that works, no matter what he's thinking about, no matter what he's doing, Riggs says. It hurt when he died in a way that it didn't hurt when other people I grew up loving died. When Lou Reed died, it was bad. When David Bowie died, it was bad. When John Prine died, it kind of broke me in a weird way. Prine worked as a mail carrier before he was discovered, writing music in his head, simple songs, narrated by characters on society's margin as he rode his daily route. Riggs similarly mines empathy from the mundane. Even their most politically charged subject, the U.S. government's persecution of sexual subversives, the stigma surrounding mental health and the fallout of the 2016 election, and their most fantastical lyrics, are always grounded in a refreshing honesty and humility. Bile and Bone is just the latest example, though knowing Al Riggs, it will only be the latest for so long. Well, that was a sort of a lead article. In fact, that was the cover article in this Indie Week. And now an actual review. And this is written by Dan Rucha, and it's about Chris Stamey and the Fellow Travelers, and their release, A Brand New Shade of Blue. This is on Omnivore Recordings, July 17. And it's a 3-star review. In a way, Chris Stamey's music has always been an archaeology of pop, particularly the pre-1970s variety. From his albums with the DBs to his work with big stars Alex Chilton and his projects as a producer, everything revolves around exploring different conceptions and inscriptions of the popular. On the Stamey's prior album, 2019's New Songs for the 20th Century, Volumes 1 and 2, the Chapel Hill native actually wrote new songs as though he were an inhabitant of Tin Pan Alley or the Real Book. The brand new Shade of Blue continues in that vein, conjuring the smoky, twilight, jazzy New York of the late 1950s, or is it the Paris of the French New Wave? Stamey is explicit about his source material. Miles Davis, Bill Evans, Thelonious Monk, Burt Bacharach, Jimmy Webb, Harold Arlen, and Antonio Carlos Jobim. And these songs are imbued with a world before the British invasion or the folk revival. They all began as lead sheets written late on winter nights, and they channel a world in which every chord change matters, painting the lyrics in different hues. An album this rooted in the past walks a fine line between copying and pastiche, and it risks falling into an uncanny valley between the past and the present. Stamey and his fellow travelers, a multi-generational band of sharp musicians, most of them from North Carolina, do a decent job navigating this. Lead vocalist Brett Harris could never be confused with one of those late 50s crooners. His wispy tones make the songs more delicate and crystalline, bringing the emotional core a little closer to the surface. And the instrumental solos and filigrees are perfectly on point, evoking cool jazz without being too beholden to it, especially on instrumentals like Un Autre Temps. The raging electric guitar solo on Cerulean Is Lovely makes it much more than a Coltrane homage. And Django Haskins shows up for the closer, dangling cheek-to-cheek, the postmodern banjo-driven romp that sounds like a slightly more buttoned-up version of Squirrel Nut Zippers. But sometimes the unreal pokes through. There are times when the lyrics seem a little too winking toward their inspirations, where they self-consciously twirl the language of the standards, like the title track or in a minor key. Some of these songs feel strangely similar, using the same kind of interchangeable building blocks. I'm not sure I could tell you the difference between In a Minor Key or It Must Be Raining Somewhere. As a result, parts of the records feel indistinct, painted in nearly indistinguishable shades of blue. Now we have time for our op-ed, which this week is written by Senator Natalie Murdoch. She represents North Carolina State Senate District 20, and her title, Child Care Facility Safety Can't Take a Back Seat During COVID. Known as the City of Medicine, Durham and the surrounding area have a high number of essential medical workers, many of them struggling to keep the rest of us safe and disease-free. But a bill passed recently by the General Assembly that will probably be signed by Governor Cooper to offer parents additional child care options may put the children of those essential health care workers at risk. As part of allocating how to spend $1.1 billion of the state's share of the federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security CARES Act funds, the state also relaxed requirements that child care facilities follow strict guidelines. Tucked into House Bill 1105, better known as Coronavirus Relief 3.0, which expanded broadband access to rural areas and allowed schools to operate without threat of loss of funds because of reduced enrollment, was a language that allowed temporary child care centers to bypass a number of safety regulations. They're no longer required to ensure that employees have background checks, including those for child abuse charges, or are CPR or first aid certified, or can pass a tuberculosis test. Additionally, centers aren't required to report confirmed COVID-19 cases to public health officials, and their facilities don't have to pass fire department regulations. to continue to offer child care options beyond the summer. The state's YMCAs asked if they could continue their summer programming and give students places to do their virtual instruction while schools are operating remotely. The state's Child Care Commission attempted to ease restrictions by having the facilities, including the YWCA, Boys and Girls Clubs, and parks and recreation centers, contract with local school systems so they could operate during the pandemic. But the facilities wanted more. The General Assembly, with HB 1105, eased restrictions, allowing them to continue to operate and not comply with restrictions required of the state's child care facilities. The bill also loosely defines child care centers so they can include any group wanting to watch children during the day, such as churches, other nonprofit orgs, or even groups of parents creating learning pods in one of their homes. The pandemic has resulted in all of us having to do things differently and adjust our schedules to ensure we are safe and not spreading COVID-19, but those alternatives should not put children at risk. Without background checks, parents don't know who could be working with their children. They may have previous convictions for child abuse. They may have COVID-19. The facility itself may have fire department violations. The list of potential issues and problems is unlimited. Language in this bill was created by the House Republicans and offered Democrats little opportunity to participate. Additionally, because the bill moved through the House and Senate so fast, the public was not allowed to review what was included. As a result, we have a flawed law. My Asheville colleague, Senator Terry Van Dyne, attempted to offer amendments that would have required the facilities to have at least one person, CPR or first aid certified, ensure background checks, and notify local health departments of COVID cases among children or staff, but that effort failed. In the interim, our children are at risk. How can we ask our frontline healthcare workers and all the others who work so hard every day to put their children at risk so we can get medical care, buy groceries, ride public transportation, tend to our elderly, and do all those things we need to survive? Contact your local state elected officials. Let them know you want this changed. You want your children and the children in your neighborhood to be safe. You should expect nothing less. Definitely have time for a food and drink article. Yum. Except for the title, Shuck and Thrive, by Eric Ginsberg. How to eat fresh, raw oysters at home without ending up in urgent care. I'm so sick of my own cooking. I used to enjoy the act of preparing a meal, getting lost in the repetitive physical motions of prep work. Modifying a recipe with what I had in the fridge felt like low stakes, yet rewarding challenge. But I've cooked more meals in the last 6 months than the previous few years combined, and it's exhausting. I crave meals that I'm not adept or patient enough to execute on my own, and yet, like many of you, I'm not willing to eat at a restaurant anytime soon, even outside. The persistent threat plus quarantine fatigue means takeout and delivery are my saving grace. But that puts some dishes, like raw oysters, in an awkward position. Fried oysters travel just fine, as proved by meals I brought home from Salt Box Seafood Joint and Scrimp Shack, both in Durham. Raw oysters aren't as straightforward. The more confident among us can order a raw oyster kit from Locals Oyster Bar. The business, which has Raleigh and Durham locations, will sell you a straight-tip oyster knife for $12 or the pricier commercial version. No doubt that's perfect for some of you, but if I snagged this bushel and attempted this do-it-yourself approach, I'd end up at urgent care. Too much work and too much risk. That's where an innovation from St. James comes in. The Durham Seafood Restaurant takes the work out of the equation by shucking the raw oysters for you, replacing the top and vacuum sealing them. Then they surround the back in ice and seal it again, keeping the oysters snug and fresh for easy transport home. Chef Matt Kelly explains in a demo video on the St. James website, "We get it. Shucking's dangerous." Says, "It was an idea I thought of to save my butt." His concept is pretty basic, really, but the results are jarringly satisfying. At home, I cut the outer layer, dumped the ice into a bowl, and then opened the inner seal, nonchalantly stacking the oysters on top. Tipping one back and slurping, I could almost hear the ocean's gentle roar as the salty contents hit my tongue. I haven't experienced anything on par with the luxurious of these bivalves since COVID hit. I might have teared up slightly and untensed my shoulders while splitting half a dozen with my wife. It was a rare moment of forgetting, of being transported to the pre-pandemic era. St. James offers a couple of side street seats underneath its awning, but with free curbside pickup delivered to your car, I see no reason for added risk. Until the pandemic clears, it's vacuum sealed or bust for me. And before Phil and Bill, our mystery duo, begin our theme from inside their cardboard boxes, I will round out this issue of Indie Week with a few more readers' survey awards selected by me. Best Auto Repair in Durham County, Wasp Automotive, and Chapel Hill Tire, and in Wake County, Gowers Brake and Alignment. We have where should we go from there? There's so many. We'll go to the best landscape company in the Triangle, TROSA, T-R-O-S-A, Lawn Care, and they also got awards for moving company and best nonprofit. So best music lessons in the Triangle, High Strung School of Music, and we have, best nonprofit in Wake County, is the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. We have, I'll just hold on a second, and I'll get you the best pet sitting service, Kate's Critter Care in Durham, and same in Chapel Hill, and then in Raleigh, Amanda's Best Friend. And I'm beginning to hear them. We'll get the best insurance agent in the Triangle, Amanda Haygood, State Farm Insurance. Well, thank you, Phil and Bill. This broadcast is also available as a podcast at the North Carolina ncreadingservice.org. I'm still John Fetterson. So long for now, folks.